had me a job down at the local mill. Work dried up, not a mill is ill. I can't pay my bills. The repo man is at my door. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. Well, I had me a wife, kids, a car, and a boat. Things got bad, now the boat won't float. I don't like it. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. We're not a working, we're not a working, we're just not working anymore. They used to call us working class, but we're just
WEFT, Champaign, 90.1 FM, and the show is Illinois World Labor Hour. And the views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associates, station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated. And this is Bob Pilesny filling in this week for Dave Johnson, and Tom Thomas is here, and he has the underwriting for this week.
The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the Illinois Education Association Teachers Union and the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice. Building coalitions amongst workers, unions, and the community, the Illinois Education Association and the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice are proud to support WEFT Community Radio in East Central Illinois. This hour of programming is also brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and a guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, as I mentioned, Dave Johnson isn't here this week. Tom, did you say he was at a Jobs for Justice
meeting? Yeah, he has his Jobs for Justice meeting at this morning at the same time that we're having the show. So
yeah,
couldn't make it today.
Yeah, so I'm here and I'll fill in. And Tom is here with his weekly labor news stories, and he'll do his poem and about half past the hour in the cultural corner. And here's a quick reminder that WEFT is a co-sponsor of trombonist Dave Dickey's Big Band, an 18-piece orchestra with faculty players from the U of I and Indiana, as well as U of I students and community players such as Jeff Helgeson. That's at the Iron Post Sunday, March 1st, 6 to 9 p.m. Tune in to Dave's Jazz Show each Friday morning, 9 to 11:30 a.m. here on WEFT 90.1 FM. And now here's Tom with the weekly labor news.
The District of Columbia's 200-year-long wait for a voice in the Congress was a step closer to ending after the Senate voted to take up legislation that would give the capital city's 600,000 residents a full seat in the House of Representatives. The Senate voted 62-34, two more than needed, to begin debate on a measure that would increase the House to 437 members. The legislation would give the Democratic-dominated city a vote while adding a fourth seat to Republican-leaning Utah. 2 years ago, the bill fell three votes short of the required 60 to end a Republican-led filibuster. This year, by the way, there are seven more Democrats in the Senate, and they appear to be getting a lot done so far. In last Tuesday's Champaign City Council primary election in District 1, only one candidate's name appeared on the ballot, but he lost. Write-in candidates Freddie Gordon significantly outpaced William Kyles. Assisted by a number of veteran campaign organizers with Democratic affiliations, Gordon received 124 votes and Kyle 78 votes. Now the two will face each other in the April 7th municipal election. Four other write-in candidates in District 1 will not advance. Annette Williams garnered three votes, Ronnie Claiborne got one vote, and Steve Roden and Charles Thomas did not receive any votes. When asked how he did it, Gordon credited his campaign team, which included Champaign County Board Democrats Michael Richards and Carol Ammons, community activists Aaron Ammons and Dave Brayfield, who was his campaign manager. One of the main problems contributing to the collapse of the U.S. housing market in the recent past is that too many borrowers are borrowing way more than they actually need. According to Gallup polls, the number of Americans taking on massive new debts to buy a home was on the increase even as foreclosures and plummeting housing services began sending shockwaves to the nation's economy. In 2007, the most recent year for which statistics are available, bankers and other lenders gave out nearly 419,000 mortgages to buyers borrowing at least four times their annual income, amounts that were unheard of prior to the crippling of the U.S. economy by the Bushites. Lenders do not typically consider the size of a loan in respect to the applicant's total income. Instead, they focus on how much of the borrower's income will be consumed by monthly loan payments, a figure that can change dramatically depending on the terms of the loan, most of which are unarmed robbery to begin with. Records filed with the Federal Financial Institutions Examination Council showed that these giant loans were most common along the West Coast and around East Coast cities such as Boston and Washington, where home prices shot up ridiculously. To folks out there considering home purchases, it would be a boon to our national economy to not borrow more than you need, remembering your banker is not your friend.
Yeah.
You are just another customer and possibly another victim. Hey, the following frightening headline appeared on a Union Yes printout from February 25, 2009. Obama administration encouraging GM and Chrysler to use the bankruptcy courts to break the UAW. The White House is reviewing several financial scenarios for automotive manufacturers, including the government-supervised bankruptcy of General Motors and the Chrysler Corporation, in order to carry out an unprecedented attack against auto workers' jobs, wages, and pensions. A Wall Street Journal report from last Monday said that outside advisors at the U.S. Treasury were trying to arrange at least $40 billion in financing for bankruptcy loans for both GM and Chrysler. Within the administration, there is a debate over the best way to break the resistance of the automakers to sweeping concessions. One faction believes it can achieve its aims by using the threat of bankruptcy and relying on the United Auto Workers Union to impose management's demands. Another faction wants to use the bankruptcy courts to tear up labor agreements, even if it means a confrontation with auto workers. The government bailout is being presented as a plan to save the auto industry, but it has nothing to do with protecting the jobs and communities of auto workers. Quite to the contrary, GM has already announced plans to eliminate over 47,000 jobs from its global workforce, including 21,000 hourly and salaried positions in the United States. And they will be closing 14 of their plants in North America and Europe. Chrysler and Ford will soon announce their own downsizing plan. Hey, finally, on the flip side of the automakers' issues, according to different polls, barely one-fourth of Americans think the government should continue lending money to Detroit automakers, even though the manufacturers are saying they'll go out of business without federal financial help. According to Porter Stansberry, head of Stansberry & Associates Investment Research, the more people understand what's wrong with General Motors, the less willing they are to support it. He pointed out that GM's interest payments on its billions of dollars of debt could very likely soak up profits for years on end, and he says the Chrysler Corporation will very likely be in the same shape. The Ford Motor Company has not yet asked the government for cash, but auto industry analysts at J.P. Morgan Chase have said that Ford is only 9 to 12 months behind General Motors in the situation. Many of those polled remain loyal to U.S.-made cars, despite the various companies' financial problems. 37% said they would buy only U.S. vehicles from U.S. automakers, and that's up from the 30% a poll recorded in December. Back to you, Bob.
Okay, usually every week we like to play some snippets from Workers Independent News, and the lead commentator there is Doug Cunningham, and he was interviewed briefly this week on another program, and he had some comments about United Auto Workers concessions, so I figured I'd follow up Tom's news stories about the auto industry there with a little bit from Doug Cunningham.
Tom Harmon here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. Your radio support group for We the People of the United States of America and, frankly, all life on Earth. If we don't start extending it to that, we're all screwed. Doug Cunningham is with us. He is the producer of Workers Independent News, the website laborradio.org. Hey, Doug, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tom, and thanks for giving workers a voice on your program.
My honor. So, what's going on in the world of labor?
Big automotive news in the auto industry. Today, the UAW this morning announced an agreement with Ford Motor Company on a deal for their retiree health care fund, which is a huge deal. There are hundreds of thousands of retirees depending on this, and the UAW has reached an agreement with Ford. It's a concessionary deal, essentially, but it allows Ford to use stock for half of the money that they're going to put into this VEBA. The reason this is so important is because the auto industry is restructuring. It's gotten those billions of dollars in government loans, so it has to cut its costs. And it agreed back in 07 to set up this healthcare trust fund and pump $46.1 billion into it, all three of the Detroit Three automakers, in exchange for getting rid of $88 billion in estimated future healthcare costs. So it's a very big deal for the auto industry, and since the auto industry is so critical to the country, it's a big deal for the country, too.
So this is good news?
Well, you know, it's risky news. It's good news that the UAW thinks it's gotten an agreement which it says will protect UAW jobs going forward because it will help make these automakers more viable. But as everybody knows, with all the stock volatility and the financial crisis, they're depending on this stock now to fund future retiree health care. And that's a big change because up to this point, the auto companies had to put cash into this trust fund. Now it's a mixture of cash and stock. And the UAW still has to get an agreement with General Motors, which has the largest number of retirees. That's 900,000 retirees and spouses at GM dependent on this health care. They still have to reach an agreement with them and with Chrysler. And there's a March 31st government deadline to convince the government that all of these ducks are in a row to make the auto industry viable again. And it's not just auto workers. I mean, if people think that it's just auto workers being affected by these deals, they're wrong. As many as 3 million jobs in this country could vanish in a hurry if one of these Detroit Three automakers goes bankrupt. So that's one of the reasons it's so important to the country at large.
What else is going on?
Well, you know, we have the Employee Free Choice Act is on the immediate horizon. We have the Senate leader, Harry Reid, saying that the Employee Free Choice Act, they could act on it as soon as this summer in Congress. That's a huge labor law reform. That's the biggest and most important labor law reform in generations. And it would set the stage for a revitalization of the labor movement if it is, in fact, passed. President Obama said he supported it when he was on the campaign trail, and it got a majority in the House, and they supported it. But the Senate, it stalled in the Senate, essentially, last time around. So this is a very important battle, and big business is going to fight this tooth and nail. They're going to spend an estimated $200 million against it. What it does is it allows workers to choose how they're going to form a union. They can form a union simply by signing cards that are government-certified union cards, and then the employers would have to recognize them. Right now, the employers can decide to force the workers into an election, and they rig the game and play the election against the workers by trying to intimidate, coerce, and scare them out of their legal right to join a union. So this is a huge deal. It's at the top of the labor agenda, and it'd be fair to say it's at the top of big business's agenda to defeat this thing.
You betcha. I have a question about that, Doug, about the politics of it. I heard an anti-Employee Free Choice Act ad the other day, one of these ads sponsored by the Better Business Group or Chamber of Commerce.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they had George McGovern on, and he said, this legislation would forbid, and I'm pretty sure he used the word forbid or make illegal or words to that effect, a private vote on whether or not a group wanted to have a union. And my understanding was that the Employee Free Choice Act says we're adding something, we're not taking something away. In other words, not only can you have the private vote as it is now, but in addition, if you don't want to do that, you can just have more than 51% of people sign a card. Was McGovern telling the truth in that? And if not, was he misinformed? I mean, how
does this with all due respect to former Senator McGovern, he's dead wrong about that. The big business big lie is that that's what it would do. What it actually does is it takes the power out of the boss's hand, out of the employer's hands, puts it into the workers' hands. So if the workers want to go about organizing their union and forming and joining their union by a secret ballot election, they can choose to do that. Under current law, if they don't want to go that route, employers can still force workers into that route. And the reason that employers want to force workers into that secret ballot, so-called secret ballot election, is because then the employers have a whole set of rules and regulations that they can pursue in a campaign against the union. So this Employee Free Choice Act takes the power and puts it into the workers' hands. It prevents employers from forcing it on the workers.
Right. Is McGovern still holding that position, do you know?
I think he is, unfortunately. He is. It's sad. It's sad, but he is.
It really is. Doug Cunningham, laborradio.org. You can get all the news. There's a lot more news where this came from. Check it out, laborradio.org, Workers Independent News. Thanks, Doug.
Thanks, Tom.
Okay, we're back. And, Tom, did you have some comments about the United Auto Workers taking stock there?
Yeah, I did. A couple of things they said really distressed me. Like, for example, when the workers' cash or funds goes into the pension fund, half cash and half stock, what if the worker doesn't want half stock? Why don't they have a choice? Where is the employee's free choice?
Yeah, I don't think they're getting any in this instance, you know. So
it doesn't sound like it.
Yeah. Let's get into a little bit of auto-related music here.
Okay.
Okay, that was Albert King with Cadillac Assembly Line. And we're back. This is WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM. And you're listening to the Illinois World Labor Hour. And coming up next, we'll have Tom Thomas and the Cultural Corner. And this week's poem, When the Revolution is Done.
Swing that hammer and push that saw. Work with fingers bloody and raw. Carry bricks with an aching back or carry heavy wood to stack. And soon enough you too will know the miseries through which we go. Since the sunrise of history, the story is no mystery. You either have to be a slave and for the boss always behave, or else be put out in the street wondering how you're going to eat. The time is now to rearrange, to stand together for that change, to end the cannibalism of the curse of capitalism, to see that every child eats and none are living in the streets. Free enterprise, they called the dream. We must pursue that as a team, till none are hungry or homeless, and each cold house with heat is blessed. We must pursue it with a lust until the pyramids are dust. Then when we reach that shining day, when equality's here to stay, no hungry child will have to cry, no homeless vagrant have to die, because we will all be as one when the revolution is done. When the Revolution is Done was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois on February 22, 2009 and was first recited live February 28, 2009 on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Okay, and a reminder that you can tune into the Medicine Wheel on Tuesday, March 3rd, for a live studio performance of the Mark O'Connor Quintet after 9 p.m., and that'll be featuring Mark O'Connor on alto and tenor sax, Jeff Helgeson, trumpet and bugle horn, Sean Purcell on guitar, Chris Nolte on bass, and Josh Hunt on drums. And another reminder that starting tomorrow, we'll be kicking off the 10th annual celebration of Women's History Month here on WEFT 90.1 FM. That'll be running March 1st to the 7th. Stay tuned every day. We'll have different programs featuring music and information about women.
For the ladies.
Yes, yes. And let's get into another segment from Workers Independent News from this week.
I think that sounds good to me.
We'll listen to Thursday's edition.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. New York City spends $9 billion a year in tax money paying private contractors to deliver public services. The American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, District Council 37's Lillian Roberts, says that's more expensive for a shadow government parallel workforce to do public jobs, and it also creates pressure to lay off public employees when they're needed the most.
It is certainly not necessary to lay off any of the workers that we have. This is a time when they should be increasing them so that they can service those that have been laid off from the private sector. And, of course, we do not only do a job, we do it more efficient and certainly at less cost.
Henry Garrido wrote the white paper that AFSCME DC 37 released on Wednesday examining private contracting's impact on New York City's budget.
Our concern is not just that it's costing more, which we have documented that it is a higher cost, but also that the services that are being provided to the public are being provided by competent, qualified individuals who have to meet that standard of merit and fitness required under the state constitution.
With state and local budgets in crisis nationwide, AFSCME says it's spending on more expensive private contractors rather than paying public employees to do the job just doesn't make sense. The concept of a worker furlough as a cost-saving measure continues to spread across the country. Jesse Russell reports.
According to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, 46 states in the union are staring down budget deficits. As a result, many have turned to the concept of a worker furlough to bridge some of the gap. The most publicized furlough fight is in California, where Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger wants state workers to take 2 unpaid furloughs per month. West Virginia's state auditor, Glenn Gaynor, told the West Virginia Gazette that he believes his state should also consider that option, but the state doesn't currently have a provision that would allow for temporary furloughs. And it isn't just states utilizing furloughs as a cost-saving measure. This week, Lynchburg, Virginia voted to furlough 1,200 city workers for 2.5 days and cut pay by 3%. The furloughs add an additional pay cut of 1%. Norfolk, Virginia is also considering worker furloughs to close a deficit gap. The Virginian Pilot reported this week that City Manager Regina Williams has said unpaid furloughs may be likely.
The U.S. Senate has finally confirmed Hilda Solis as Labor Secretary. She's the most pro-worker Labor Secretary in many years. Jesse Russell has today's economic report.
January saw mass layoffs expand by 50% in comparison to the same time last year. The Bureau of Labor Statistics showed Ohio as one of the worst-hit states with a jump of 180% in mass layoffs in comparison to January 2008. General Motors was the biggest culprit when it came to job cuts in the Buckeye State. Unemployment claims across the nation were up by 60% over last year.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Okay, we're back. And a couple comments about stories that were on that Workers' Independent News. The day before, they had a story on there talking about those worker furlough days. Oregon State is wanting to put in place a plan that workers would take 26 unpaid furlough days over the next 2 years. That's quite amazing there.
It's like 2 weeks unpaid vacation every year.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And a little bit of another follow-up there about they mentioned Hilda Solis finally confirmed as Labor Secretary.
Yeah, I've heard something about it. You know, I haven't really researched her her history, but I have heard good things about her.
Yeah, I've got a story here that that was Wednesday, I believe. The Senate this afternoon confirmed Representative Hilda Solis as Labor Secretary more than 2 months after she was nominated for the post by President Obama. The Senate voted 80-17 to confirm Solis after Senate Republicans today assured Democrats that they would not filibuster the nomination. Solis had come under fire from Senate Republicans who thought she was unresponsive to many of their questions during the confirmation hearing, a situation that was compounded by her work as treasurer for American Rights at Work, a pro-labor group. There were also concerns among some Republicans about her support for a measure that would make it easier for workers to organize unions, the Employee Free Choice Act. Consideration of Solis' nomination was further delayed when it was revealed that her husband had recently paid about $6,400 to settle tax liens against his California auto repair business. While Solis' nomination generated skepticism among many Republicans and their backers in the business community, the new labor secretary enjoys solid support among members of organized labor. The daughter of immigrants from Mexico and Nicaragua, both of Solis' parents were union members. Also, as a member of Congress, Solis has shared union skepticism toward free trade agreements and been a strong proponent of developing jobs in renewable energy and other green-collar areas. America's working men and women will be fortunate to have someone of Hilda's tremendous talents leading the Department of Labor. She knows the huge challenges facing workers and their families, and she has the experience and dedication needed for this vital position, said Senator Edward Kennedy, chairman of the Senate's Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. It's been a privilege to work with her in Congress, and I look forward very much to working with her as secretary. Labor leaders applauded Solis' confirmation. The confirmation of Representative Hilda Solis is a huge victory. Finally, Americans have a Secretary of Labor who represents working people, not wealthy CEOs, said the AFL-CIO President John Sweeney. And quotes from Andrew Stern, president of the Service Employees International Union, he says, "This is a proud moment that a child of immigrants who went to a public university could now be a member of the president's cabinet speaks incredibly highly of our country." So,
and for a change, some of the people are beginning to run the show.
Yeah, and here's another story, and this is somewhat against Andy Stern and the SEIU. We've mentioned this a little bit before in the past on this show, Tom, about United Health Workers West and how they're Andy Stern's put a trustee in place in their union, and they were trying to take over the union out there.
Yeah.
And United Health Workers West is basically leaving SEIU and starting their own union now. And
that covers California and all the states adjacent to California?
I think so, yeah. It's typically out west. Now, the new union that they're forming, it will be nationwide, you know.
Yeah.
So here's a story about a majority of Kaiser Permanente's 50,000 workers have signed a petition to disaffiliate with United Healthcare Workers West and instead join the newly formed National Union of Healthcare Workers. The bargaining unit is one of the largest among the nation's private sector employers, and taking it over would be a significant coup for NUHW, officials said. The new group was created last month by former leaders of United Healthcare Workers West after the Oakland-based local was taken over by its parent organization, the Service Employees International Union, the culmination of a long fight over organizing and bargaining methods. One of the new group's stated goals was to win the right to represent United Healthcare Workers West 150,000 members. Within days of its creation, the fledgling group began filing requests with the National Labor Relations Board for elections at United Healthcare Workers' representative workplaces, saying a majority of workers signed petitions asking to disaffiliate with United Healthcare Workers West and join National Union of Healthcare Workers. NUHW said it is filing a similar petition for Kaiser's facilities today, bringing to 80,000 the number of unionized employees in play. Hopefully, we'll dole out some justice here, said Brian Williams, a technician at Kaiser's Sunset facility, who said he was ousted as United Healthcare Workers West contract specialist by its new trustees. If nothing else, it gives our members the choice. The 2 million member SEIU has fought back. More than 100 staffers from across the country have been sent to California to keep workers in UHW and run the local. SEIU officials said some members signed the Kaiser disaffiliation petition without understanding it. It also has filed complaints with the National Labor Relations Board accusing NUHW of violating labor laws by failing to bargain in good faith with employers in advance of the trusteeship. SEIU said the former leaders of UHW kept contracts open to allow them to make a play for those workers. In most instances, workers under contract are typically barred from switching unions. UHW's newly appointed trustees said the former leaders failed in their duty to represent the members of this union by allowing contract negotiations to languish, some for as long as 8 months. As a result, the National Labor Relations Board has launched an investigation, and NUHW officials said elections have been postponed on all their petitions. It's just totally made up to simply cause the cancellation of the hearing and investigations by the overburdened NLRB, said Sal Roselli, who was ousted as president of United Healthcare Workers West by SEIU and among the leaders of the new union. He said his local continued to sign strong contracts until the day he was ousted. So
sounds like a soap opera to me.
Yes, yes. So back into some music here. One of our favorites, Ann Feeney.
Listen up. We've got a war zone here today, right in our heartland. And across the USA, these multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true. But they've declared a war on us. Fight back, it's up to you. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time we started calling the shots. Going to work could be the death of you and me, but we're not unarmed. Our weapon solidarity, Jim Beals and Karen Silkwood, the list goes on and on. With every year that passes, 60,000 more gone. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time we started calling the shots. When they boost your copay,
war on the workers.
Don't you know what to say?
War on the workers.
When they talk privatization,
war on the workers.
And cooperation,
war on the workers.
talk flexibility.
War on the workers.
Every working stiff can see.
War on the workers.
Now when they poison your water.
War on the workers.
Don't go like lambs to the slaughter.
War on the workers.
And when they foul up the air.
War on the workers.
You gotta show that you care.
War on the workers.
When they talk WTO.
War on the workers.
You best be screaming hell no. Education, it's a war on child labor protection, it's a war on the 8-hour day, it's a war on occupational health and safety, it's a war on social security. Now thanks to WTO, GATT, NAFTA, MAI, the IMF and the World Bank, it's a worldwide war. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Yeah, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time, sisters and brothers, you know it's time right now. I said it's time. We started calling the shots.
Okay, Ann Feeney, War on the Workers.
And it's time we started calling the shots.
That's for sure. And I'm going to play another segment here from Workers Independent News. This is actually next Monday's segment. And we'll listen to that now.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. President Barack Obama is tightening belts all around, including those of federal workers. Under Obama's budget, civilian federal workers would have pay raises capped at 2% in 2010. Military personnel would be given a slightly larger pay raise of 2.9%. The administration says they made the decision to tighten pay raises, so public sector worker increases would be similar to what is happening in the private sector. In 2009, workers received a pay raise of 3.9%, and in 2008, they received an increase of 3.5%. Military personnel received a pay increase of 3.9% in 2009. The 2% cap is Obama's suggested pay raise for the federal workforce, but the actual raise given to workers would be based on promotions and regional factors. Militant Solidarity not only won the day for Chicago workers who took over their factory last year, that action will also help them stay employed this year. Doug Cunningham has the report.
When United Electrical Workers members used a sit-down strike to occupy their Republic Windows and Doors factory in Chicago, they wanted wages and vacation pay they were owed after the plant owners abruptly announced that the plant was closing. The workers got their money, and now they'll be returning to work at the factory, still represented by their union. Sirius Materials has completed the purchase of Republic Windows and Doors, clearing the way for the plant to reopen. UE Local 1110 has also reached a collective bargaining agreement with the new plant owners, and the sit-down strike workers will be rehired at their former rate of pay. UE says that an announcement regarding the opening day of the new Sirius Material production facility will be forthcoming. UE says it looks forward to working with the new company to create and sustain green jobs at living wages. Militant Solidarity and the bold sit-down strike tactic scored a big victory for these workers in the midst of the worst economy in a generation.
A New York State Department of Labor investigation of Amish Markets chain of upscale on-the-go stores found the company had violated overtime laws. According to the department, workers were putting in up to 60 hours of work per week without overtime compensation. Amish Market has agreed to pay $1.2 million in overtime wages to nearly 550 employees. The violations were brought to the attention of the Labor Department by UFCW Local 1500. Here is today's economic report. Jobless claims are at a 26-year high. 667,000 new unemployment claims were filed in February, with 5.1 million already on the dole. The average unemployment payment is $300 per week, with an increase of $25 per week set to start under the stimulus plan.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Okay, and that final story there. The Labor Department said Thursday that first-time requests for unemployment benefits jumped to 667,000 from the previous week's figure of 631,000, and analysts had actually expected a slight drop in claims. The new claims are the most since October 1982. The four-week average of initial claims, which smooths out fluctuations, rose to 639,000, the highest in more than 26 years. Separately, U.S. manufacturers saw orders for big-ticket goods plunge by a larger-than-expected 5.2% in January as global economic troubles cut demand from customers at home and abroad.
A lot of that was in the auto industry.
Almost every industry, Tom, I think, is being
affected.
Well,
yeah, every industry has been affected, I'm saying. It's very high in the auto.
Yeah, all throughout the auto industry. You know, it's not just the big three U.S. automakers.
Oh, yeah.
Toyota and Honda sales are down like 40%. They're laying off people and closing factories.
GM closed down. Now, I can't remember the name. It's one of their subsidiary companies that makes one of their car models. 15,000 people laid off.
Yes.
Without any promise of coming back.
Yeah.
Delphi. That was what it was, Delphi.
Yeah, yeah, they're one of their part suppliers like that. Yeah, yeah. The latest report on U.S. factory activity released by the Commerce Department showed orders falling for a record sixth straight month. The previous record of 4 months came in 1992. Meanwhile, the number of people receiving unemployment insurance for more than 1 week also increased more than expected to 5.1 million. That's the fifth straight week the figure has set a new record high on data going back to 1967. And compared with only 2.8 million people a year ago. Now we're up to 5.1 million.
Twice as many as a year ago.
Exactly, exactly. An additional 1.4 million people were receiving benefits under an extended unemployment compensation program approved by Congress last year. As of February 7th, the latest data available, that brings the total number of jobless benefit recipients to roughly 6.5 million. Okay. And on a slightly different topic here, I was following some stuff that was going on in Guadalupe and Martinique. And there was a strike in Guadalupe going on. I think it's been going on for about 6 weeks now.
Yeah, I believe I heard about that a couple of weeks ago, actually, two or three weeks ago.
Yeah. Unions in the French Caribbean island of Guadalupe have signed a deal to raise worker salaries but have not ended a five-week-long general strike. The agreement will see the wages of the lowest-paid workers supplemented with a 200 euro, or about $250, monthly payment. But union leaders said the strike would continue until France's government had addressed spiraling prices, which are far higher than on the French mainland. The strike has crippled the island and occasionally erupted into violence. Last week, union leader Jacques Bino was shot dead by rioting youths at a barricade in Guadalupe's largest city, Pointe-à-Pitre.
Now, is Guadalupe a colony of France or a possession?
It's a, let's see. Both Guadalupe and Martinique are full overseas departments of France, was what they call them.
Departments.
Yes, and I'm not sure. It says, but prices on the islands are generally higher, while wages are lower than on the mainland, and unemployment stands at 20%. Hundreds of police and gendarmes have been deployed from France to support local security forces and help restore order. Unions and employer groups on Guadalupe signed an agreement on Thursday to pay them the $250 extra a month, and other workers will see a wage increase of about 6%, though this will be negotiated separately by each sector. And the French state will contribute half of the wage increase from 2009 to 2011. And a quote from French President Nicolas Sarkozy says, it is absolutely not right for prices to be much higher in the West Indies than in metropolitan France. And like I say, there was a funeral and for Jacques Bino, who got killed by the youths that were rioting. And about 3,000 mourners on Sunday turned the funeral for a labor union activist killed in Guadalupe into a political demonstration calling out for higher wages and respect from the French government. People clad mostly in white packed a gymnasium in the cane-growing area of Petit Canal to hear poems about struggle and songs in homage to Jacques Bino, the labor union activist shot to death last week in the French Overseas Department. And they call it that word again, department.
Department.
So I don't know if that means colony or what. But
I don't think a department would be a colony. I think it would be more like a possession.
Yes, yes. Some of the participants wore T-shirts emblazoned with images of Vino, who was killed as he drove home from a meeting with the organizers of protests that had paralyzed the French island for more than a month. And it says, "We are saddened, but we will continue to fight," the Guadalupe protest leader Elie D'Amato told mourners in a speech. And like I say, Martinique is joining in the unrest there. In the French Prime Minister François Fillon said on Thursday security forces would maintain order on the Caribbean island of Martinique after youths clashed with police overnight in a protest over economic conditions. The unrest on Martinique has spread from the neighboring island of Guadalupe, where talks to end the general strike that has dragged on since January appeared to be making progress. And as I said earlier, they've resolved part of that strike, but now they're striking over increasing prices. So, "We will not let disorder become established in Martinique," Fillon told reporters following a meeting with 30 deputies from France's overseas territories. "There is no reason for violence to interfere with negotiations, and we will deploy all measures necessary to ensure the security of persons and property in Martinique." And we're going to listen to a little more music here. Bob Marley song, Work.
Bob Marley.